Good afternoon. Welcome to Turnout Radio on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Nicole Inika Hamilton, back to open up with you about the latest on the dance scene and the heart of what moves us. It's so good as always to be back with you on this Wednesday afternoon. Thank you for joining us in this dance space. Well, friends, my guest today has been known to reflect upon the following words. Dance is the food for the soul. Words shared with her from her godmother, which profoundly speak to the impression and the impact of dance. Coming up on the broadcast, Emily Chung, artistic director of the Little Pear Garden Dance Company, is in the house and will be opening up about the company, its 30-year history, and much, much more. So stay tuned and stay locked in right here on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to take a break and be right back with Emily Chung. Welcome back to Turnout Radio on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Nicole Inika Hamilton. My guest today, Emily Chung's work is a reflection of her deep understanding of dynamics and cultural intersections. She believes that dance is a powerful medium to explore these nuances. She has dedicated herself to preserving traditional forms while infusing them with contemporary sensibilities. Now, this commitment shines through in her choreographic endeavors, with notable works including Spectrum of Connection, a full-length production which delves into the complexities of globalization, human travel, and migration. Through dance, Emily explores the threads that connect us all. And as the artistic director of the Little Pear Garden Dance Company, she has created an environment which fosters passion, integrity, and excellence among Canadian artists. Emily has been recognized as one of the voices of Chinese Canadian women during Canada's 150th anniversary celebration. It's in this dance-filled journey that she continues to nurture creativity, celebrate diversity, and leave an indelible mark on the world of movement. It's my true pleasure to welcome Emily Chung to the show. Emily, welcome to Turnout Radio.
Thank you, Nicole. Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Well, you are just bringing all the light and joy into this space today. How have you been doing?
Well, I've been doing quite well. We just finished celebrating our 30th anniversary 2 weeks ago. Yes. We were in Oakville with another tour with our Spectrum of Connection production. And so this week is a fabulous week to be talking to you, Nicole, because I am taking my time off and relaxing and chilling.
Oh, well, I love all of the above. All of the above. Congratulations on 30 years. We're going to be talking more about that during the course of the show, but I've got to say it now. Congratulations to you and all in the company.
Thank you very much. It's such an honor to be working for this company this long. And the company was founded by William Lau, and I took over 18 years ago. It seems like it's a long time, but to be honest, this role requires so many different roles and putting so many different hats. So I feel like I'm still learning, you know, to become a good artistic director and a choreographer and an artist. So it's a long lifelong journey.
Yes, yes. Well, the learning never stops, does it?
No, you're right. It never stops. Yes.
Well, in that learning, I want to come back to something I had shared at the top of the interview. Dance is the food for the soul, Emily. Yvonne Chu, your godmother and a strong advocate of dance, shared those words with you many years ago. I'd love to open up there and talk about how those words have impacted the spirit of who you are, including your artistic practice.
Oh, absolutely. As someone who is a Chinese Canadian, my family, my parents immigrated here when I was 9 years old, and I was still dancing at that time. And throughout this journey of dance, I have really been able to found myself in terms of my roots as, you know, a Chinese you know, immigrants from Hong Kong, China, which is now called China. And at the same time, you know, learning from many, many pioneers that you know, that we have in Canada, bringing such great diversity. And it really opened up my mind, my space, and also the creative aspect as well, and learning other culture from different, you know, dance forms. And it is dance that really saved me from all these identity crises, and as well as, you know, sometimes you just don't know who you really are. And I think, you know, it is a great vehicle in the arts to teach and educate this way. In, you know, there are many vehicles of learning culture, like people's culture, but definitely dance is one of the main vehicle that I heavily relied on in terms of creating who I am today.
As we explore the elements, Emily, of your history, culture, practice, and also the element of how dance has saved you, what have you learned about your holistic being?
I really appreciate you asking me, Nicole. Throughout this process, not just you know, in the journey of an artistic director and a choreographer, but as someone who loves to create and spend most of my time and my life with dance, I feel like dance has given me an opportunity to be a better person in terms of nurturing other people, learning what I have, and also to also keep a very open mind, because we know that too, especially here in Canada, but also these days globally, we have very different, you know, people coming from different background and culture. And when you talk about dance and techniques, and, you know, the dancers come from various different backgrounds, and it is very important for me to have an open mind and to learn about them. And I often think, you know, learning for life is a very important thing for all of us. So I really do enjoy that. And that's definitely part of who I am. I also, something that is very, very important to me is to allow differences so that we can find similarities, but also differences. It is okay to be different. No one is saying that, you know, in this dance world, you are required to look a certain way or to have a certain body type. I think it's very, very important that we respect that differences and also allow difference to happen. And I think last but not least is the identity. I think dance saved me in terms of knowing who I am, revisiting my roots, and as well as, you know, carrying forward as someone who is here in Canada, who am I? Allowing that creativity that speaks to, you know, me using, you know, various different philosophy, Chinese philosophy and contemporary works, which really speaks to me and hopefully to those who enjoy dance.
And now it's been many years of you leading at the helm of Little Pear Garden Dance Company, founded in 1994 by William Lau. How did your relationship with the company and William begin?
I was a student at that time, undergraduate student at York University, and William was doing his master's, and I believe he graduated at that time already. One of the professor really wanted to invite him in to as a guest artist to talk about Peking Opera, and as someone who is visible but minority, I just got really curious of like who this Chinese artist is. So I went and I snuck my head inside the lecture hall because it was for master's, a graduate school at that time. And I snuck my head in and I saw him talking about Peking Opera. He talked about all the martial arts and all the elements of miming and so on. And even though I'm not part of, you know, that class, I just stood outside. I listened to that. I think it was an hour and a half lecture. I waited for him to come out because I know at the end he's going to leave. And so he came out and I introduced myself as an undergraduate student at York at that time. And immediately he said, you know, you must help me volunteer. You know, do you have time? And I said, yes, of course I have time. So I started with the company volunteering as a I was guest dancer for him. At one point, I was doing a lot of emceeing. I still remember at that time, I was really a really shy kid, and I can't speak in front of thousands of people, 100 or even like 10 people. And so I sort of said, well, William, I'm not, you know, good at MC. And he said, don't worry about it. Just practice, and here's your chance. You know, I needed this help, and I want you to be an MC. And so I guess he started training me already in private, not even knowing that he was training me. I thought I was just helping. And then eventually he said one day to me that, I've learned what I need to do for a Little Pear, and I think it's time for me to move on. And I was doing my master's at that time. And he said, you know, are you interested? And I said, well, I can't do Peking Opera like you. I'm a dancer. And so William said, don't worry. When it's your company, you take on whatever you want to do. You want to change it to dance, by all means, it's all yours. And so I said at that time, you know, I was thinking, I just graduated. I don't know where I want to go at that time yet. And I said, you know, yes, I am interested. And so I think after a couple of years of training, he was mentoring me and I was at that time the associate artistic director. And he said, well, you know, this is yours now, Emily, like take it and fly with it. And so, and I said, okay, great. So as someone who just kind of graduated in master, don't know much about, you know, at that time, grant writing, how do you do books, like go bookkeeping? What does it take to be an AD? I had no idea, except for I have the passion of dance and that's what I want to do. And so it took me, you know, I think 17 years now and counting of this training. And I still feel I'm learning every day. And so that is sort of like the encounter I have with him and the relationship with William. And we were really delighted to have him perform our 30th anniversary, sharing this stage, wonderful stage with him.
Yes, yes. And prior to the interview, you were talking about what it takes to sustain a company. What was involved in that nurturing process that took place with William? And what were you able to pull from that in order to move the company forward?
Yes, that's a very good question, because William always have a saying, and I think you know that in Chinese. That was one thing that he taught me, like to make sure that you eat whatever was given, sort of like in terms of like, you know, you have $2, then don't spend like $5, because your company will suffer quite a bit, you know, in the next few years because of that. So that was one thing he have taught me, but also many other things as well too. He told me how a board should be functioned in a way, but he also left a lot of freedom for me to create my own legacy, because he felt strongly that, you know, every artist and should have his own approach. So even though he would be showing me like, you know, you got to deal with your budget, you got to deal with grant writing, you got to deal with board of directors, you need to deal with this and that, I think most importantly, he is telling me like, Emily, don't, this is like his exact word, right? Emily, don't worry. Just do whatever you love. You'll be fine. So those were his exact words. And I often kind of like, I was very nervous when I was young because I did not know what it entails many times. But he assured me, he said, you know what? Don't worry, Emily, you'll be fine as long as you have that passion in you. It's, you know, you will do great. Just remember what I say, tai song sik fan, you know, just eat whatever, like spend whatever you're capable. Don't overspend it. Then you'll be fine. And you know, surely enough, I was listening to what he gave me. and until now, I mean, the company has been doing really well, both financially, artistically, and you know, in terms of what we want to present as well. So yes, I think this is like, that's sort of like our working relationship in a way, because he shortly went and became a grand officer. And he precisely tell me, it's like, don't call me anymore, Emily, unless it's like, you know, I can't talk to you about grants because now there's a conflict of interest. So at that time, like I understood that, you know, his role and his different hat now. And so I did, like I went in my own way. I found different opportunities, opening different cans of worms, you know, trying different things, exploring. And that got me 17 years right there. So that is how it all kind of began.
To know that somebody who's mentoring you and teaching you pours this wisdom into you and then says, fly, take it forward. You know, I think that there, of course, can be fear that comes out of that, but also this wonderful revelation of knowing that there is also an opportunity to creatively consider how we move it forward while also being very mindful of legacy.
Yes, you're definitely right. It's because we're in the arts, if it was science or math, then there's only a right and wrong answer. But being the art, the most beautiful thing is that there's always this freedom of creativity and also to explore various things and to know what works and what doesn't. And, you know, you can keep going with it, or you can just say, okay, you know, this is boring. Let's just change it up. So it goes with the same with the company as well, and how, you know, we approach differently. In the past, we have been performing a lot of, as you know, when William's here picking opera, and he often put a lot of dance as well on stage. And when I took over the company, definitely dance was the main element. But then I asked myself, you know, is that it? No, I mean, dance has so many different forms and styles. So we are quite unique, the little pair, because we're able to perform both traditional folk dance and as well as contemporary dance. And we work with many different artists as well, you know, sort of like in a multifaceted world that we're living in right now, you know, with technology now even, and also with, you know, other artists like, you know, soprano, Vanya is going to be singing with us when we perform. So all these elements really added more layers in the arts and especially in dance. So it's not the day-to-day dance that you see, oh, I'm going to a theater, I'm seeing the same thing. No, I feel like Little Paris has always something new and exciting to put on stage.
As artistic director, you follow a core principle that's centered on embracing cultural diversity and understanding the historical and customary contexts of various art forms. And so can you share more about the core principles of the company?
Definitely. And I think the core principle is very much related to my belief as well, as someone who was brought up in Canada, and also my experience. So when I talk about the core value of Little Pear, it's really like my personal value as well, because I have to believe in it in order to create. And I think it really has to do with this, you know, diversity of language, of culture that I have been soaking up when I was young. Ever since I arrived Canada, I studied with Manika Taka in Indian dance, and shortly after Hari, who brought me to all the way to India, to Mumbai, and to perform. And so at that time, I already thought about, oh my goodness, I can totally relate Chinese dance, but at the same time, like the differences as well, that really fascinates me. So for example, like the, you know, back in the old days in the Silk Road, where there's a lot of economic exchange throughout, you know, the area with India, including India, even Greece, and also, you know, various different parts of the country. So it is from there I found out that, you know, Buddhism traveled to China and created this, you know, the Dun Huang dance style, which then kind of flourished in China because of that. And then I went back to the Indian dance form, the Bharatanatyam, and I kind of studied their form, which is really very similar to the Dun Huang dance that we have in China. So ever since I was young, like I paid close attention to the various different cultural aspects, but I also learned that, you know, we also have to be very sensitive and respectful with the culture. We can't just take something and said, I'm just going to get really inspired and see where I go from there. Because to me, you know, even there was one time 6-7 years ago, I traveled to a very a province in China that is called Yunnan. And Yunnan has probably the most diversity minority groups in that one province, like 24 minority groups. So I traveled there on purpose and I studied each and every single ethnic groups that I was going to travel. And I learned a great deal in terms of like the custom, the cultural aspect. Like when you go there and you don't pat the kids on their head, because, you know, sometimes when they're cute, they're like, oh, you're so cute. It's like, you don't do that in a certain culture because it's considered very disrespectful, or yes, it actually means that, you know, that kid is going to have bad luck for like 3 years or something like that. So I learned a great deal that, you know, even as someone who is Chinese, I still have to study, you know, what is considered respectful and not. And when I take these dance forms back to Canada and perform on stage, I always have to keep in mind that, you know, I need the leaders within those community to say, okay, you're allowed to do this. And I would send videos, and there's a lot of communication of like yays and nays until, you know, the community said, okay, yes, you can perform this, you're good enough. And I say, thank you, you know, giving credits and all that, obviously. But I learned a great deal of like, when you work with multiculturalism, you need to, you know, it's not just the superficial layers of just like, well, this is cool and this is not, let's just use this, let's not use that, and or just read like a page from somewhere and say, you know, let's do this. And I just feel like, you know, when you delve into someone's culture, you need to really be very considerate and sensitive. And so I think I take this as a core for a little pair when we're working with very different artists and different cultural groups. Yeah, and that's probably one of the elements, but but I also hold strongly about when we talked about nurturing and education, that being very important when someone is promoting a cultural dance form. And I do have a degree in education. And so I believe strongly that, you know, going to different schools and performing, say, Chinese dance, it's going to leave a mark, my hope is to leave a mark and implanting seeds into these little, small little, you know, kids and children's brain to appreciate, like, not just only Chinese culture, but like other people's culture. Maybe they will make a comparison and similarities. Maybe they are from another culture and say, hey, you know, we do something like this similar to us. And like, you know, why is it similar? And maybe they will dive in into like studying more history and learn more about it. So for me, education is also very important, and as well as nurturing, because of I look at Little Pear as like my own family, you know, like my mom, my parents who taught me things, and their parents, my god, you know, my grandparents teaching my parents. So now that I have a son, you know, my next generation, where I'm going at. So I hold that dearly, just like, you know, in Little Pear. So whatever William was teaching me, I hope that, you know, our next generation is not going to be just like us, but better. I want my kids to be better. So I want the next generation to be better. And I believe that, you know, we only have 100 years of our lives at most to live on this planet, but the culture stays forever and ever. And we always have to look for new blood and new, you know, younger generation artists who actually share that same passion and will want to take on the torch and roll with it, just like what William did to me. Yes. And I really think that is very, very important.
Emily, during our break, we were discussing the relationship between Chinese classical dance and Chinese contemporary dance. Can you talk about some of the intersections of philosophies to be considered?
Definitely. So what is Chinese classical dance? So Chinese classical dance is a technique that was developed after the Cultural Revolution. And from that time on, there are various different choreographers in China that created this dance, including Madame Dai Ailian, which is our patron. And she developed the classical Chinese dance Dun Huang style. And now there's a new kind of form that has been developed called the Han Tang style. Classical Chinese dance, even though we say classical, it's pretty much a revisit of what the olden Chinese, I guess, cultural is like. So it's still full of imagination. It's they did like went for a long time research onto you know, what you know, of guessing, but also researching what those people, those dancers, or those dancing is like way back when. But because it was after the Cultural Revolution, at that time, China and Russia had a really great relationship. So they actually, the dance form has a lot of balletic moves in it. And as well as Peking Opera, like they inserted miming and also some martial arts aspect, and as well as Peking Opera style. So this become, as we call, the Chinese classical dance. And now, you know, being here in Canada as someone who is an artist and still living, I ask myself, is this part of me? Is this who I am, you know, now that, you know, I'm in Canada? So a big part of me is saying I must keep my cultural heritage because this identifies who I am. But at the same time, as someone who is in Canada, having this wonderful privilege of learning from some wonderful pioneers, some dance pioneers, I said to myself, well, you know, we are more than that now. We not only now have to keep our heritage, but also understand others with a lot of respect and credit, integrity, obviously. So I asked myself then, you know, so what now? Like, are you going to be performing cultural dance forever? And I told myself, no, because I also love contemporary dance as well. And so this whole thing sort of started 10 years ago. And I told myself, well, is there going to be an element of mixing contemporary dance and Chinese dance? And my answer is that yes, but I need to delve more into it. It needs a lot more study than just, okay, let's just put this two together. So for the last 2 years, funny enough, I've been building a vocabulary, a new vocabulary of my own for my dance company. Right now I call it the Cheng syllabus because it's like my last name, but I have been infusing Chinese philosophy with contemporary works. I've been infusing Chinese calligraphy into contemporary dancers. So what we did was 2 years ago, with the help of National Ballet of Canada sharing space, they gave me, I think, 2 weeks at that time to explore this movement. And I got all my dancers to learn how to write with a, you know, paintbrush in terms of like Chinese calligraphy and how to write Chinese words. And during that process, we talked about, you know, the empty space that is often used on the paper canvas as something that we can build upon it instead of the writing of the words. We also talk about the elements of the yin and yang, obviously, and also we talk about the pressure that is applied into the paper. And how does that feel when you embody it into our own kind of creativity? And when the brush stroke is gliding, are you taking slowly your brush stroke away or you're pressing even harder? How about the speed? What about the speed of a, you know, brush stroke? Is it going to be really fast, like do, 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 do? Or are you taking your time to glide? And does that talk about the movement quality? Like, how does that impact or reflect upon the movement quality? So we had a, you know, very intensive of 2 weeks exploration. And then I would use my dad's calligraphy because he's a calligraphy artist, a Chinese calligraphy artist. So I asked my dad to write like different forms of Chinese words, and I would use that as an example. So I consider that quite an emotional journey for me because I am also implementing my own, like my dad's calligraphy, and then sort of implement it into my own artistic creation. And actually that's how I come up with Spectrum of Connection. It is actually through the communication with my dad from very ancient time all the way to very futuristic. So the show actually talks about, you know, Chinese calligraphy, and it moves all the way to where pandemic was, which was 2 years ago, with the Zoom that we had right now, where things are kind of cut off. We find it very convenient to use the, you know, the virtual format, but at the same time, things could go wrong as well. So then you ask yourself, right, it's a more of a question, you know, is this like a better tool for communication? Like, yes, it's very easy because you can do it in your own home instead of meeting in person. And then I talk about the futuristic AI, the robotic sort of like humanoid, you know. So that is sort of like the spectrum of connection, and that's the vocabularies I have built throughout the 2 years.
And in all of these explorations, how has it informed the stories that you tell on stage?
The stories that tell on stage, it's the communication. So we focus on the different ways. So from calligraphy, so handwritten letters, so to speak, all the way to how people connect to one another in ancient time, where we would meet in an olden place and we would talk for hours just to understand each other. And then we move on to, you know, how people connect with telephones and then to cell phone and then all the way to virtual. And then so this to me is an open question for our audience. It actually leaves a taste for them to really seek what are the best way of communication in the end. So it's actually a question implementing back to them and say, like, is this moving forward to this technology? Is this better for humanity, or is it worst for us? Because way back when I can't really talk to my friends all the way, say in Italy or France or, you know, even in China. And now it's just a phone call away. And way back when, like, it's like per minute charge, it can be very costly. And now there are like different, you know, apps you can download where you can talk to people for free. So it is sort of like a throwback to the audience and say, like, you know, what do you think now that we're moving to more of a futuristic and technological sort of era? Is this the better way of communication?
We were discussing the relationship between Chinese classical dance and Chinese contemporary dance, Emily. And I'm wondering, what considerations have you discovered about telling traditional stories on stage that honor cultural history while also considering the future? What have you discovered?
That's a very good question. I think for someone who is involved with cultural dance form, it is very important that we stay true to the style. But when we talk about contemporary format, I think the most important is how it relates to us these days in the 21st century, because some of this storytelling may not be relevant anymore for you know, today's living. So for example, let me give you an example. My first full length is called The Venom of Love. And this full length is composed by Alice as well. And this story is actually thought by myself. We are using this really old, ancient, famous, legendary story called The White Snake, The Legendary of White Snake. And the story itself is about this scholar encountered this white snake demon. And she is beautiful and they fall in love. And this demon was supposed to eat his soul. But because she also fell in love with the scholar, she didn't. Until one day, a Buddhist monk came and saw that the scholar is hanging out with a demon, a white snake demon. And so he tried to capture her and put her back into a pagoda. And that's the end of the story. Like, that's pretty much like that's what happened. But so what I did with my story is that, you know, I told myself, I was like, hey, you know, why does always like these legendary story, the woman, the female always have to suffer? It's always women suffering. Second of all, I said, well, you know, is demon that bad? And like, we always have this connotation, like demons are like evil spirits. But then in my mind, I was like, well, you know, she is falling in love and she sacrificed her love for the scholar, and she helped the scholar a lot, like so the story say. And so I said, well, she's not really a bad person after all. And so I have all these questions listed. And then I said, you know what, like this ancient story is not really relevant to us anymore. So I changed it. I changed it to the ending is when the scholar actually, because of love, he turned himself into a blue snake. So he turned himself to a demon in order to be with the white snake, the demon. So both of them actually turned into demon. And then I also tweaked the story by saying, you know, the green snake, there's also a green snake, which is a little sister, a younger sister of the white snake. She got really jealous because every day the white and the green snake would spend time together as sisters. But ever since the white snake fell in love with the scholar, you know, she kind of neglected her. And so I put a spotlight on the green snake and her encounter with a monkey demon, which then they fall in love as well, because the monkey demon saw how painful and how hurtful, how broken heart the green snake is because of the neglect of the white snake. So in the end, you know, the monkey demon came along and tried to comfort her. And throughout this process, she also found her true love, the monkey demon. And so I put a lot of various tweak into the story, which made it more relevant for us right now. But at the same time, I'm trying to keep the story alive. And I do tell people, like, this is like a new way of, you know, new story that we're telling. And if you're interested in the actual legendary story, you can go and visit, you know, a lot of YouTubes and stuff will have that story. But this is our approach of, you know, saying how people can be different and it's acceptable. It doesn't matter if you're a good person or bad person, you know, in the eyes of ourselves, you know, that person can be good as well, because it's she sacrificed herself for others. So yeah, leaving another question of like, how do you differentiate whether that person is good and bad?
And so there's this retelling of the story that allows for an honoring of history while also interrogating and considering what does it mean? What does the story mean as we press forward?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So because the legend of the white snake is very well known for like a lot of Asian country, including even Japan and Taiwan. And so they all know about this story really well. And I thought to myself, what is a better way of retelling it? But then, you know, make a twist, because I think it's important for us, for younger generation, to understand, you know, the differences. You know, we don't follow everything exactly, but we take it with a grain of salt. And, you know, there's to make it more relevant for us these days.
So how do you approach the considerations, the very important considerations of oral tradition with the dancers within your company?
It is very hard. My company dancers consist of various different dancers, background dancers, and they also have very different dance history as well. Like some of them are, contemporary dancers, and some more balletic, and some like really Chinese, focus on Chinese classical, and some focus on folk dance. So the communication takes quite a long time, especially when I teach them, a very specific cultural historical dance. And I often tell my dancers, whoever they are, I said, you know what? When you learn this dance, you want to make sure that you can talk about it. What if one day someone's going to come up to you and say, "Great show. Can you tell me more about Mongolian dance?" And the last thing I would want them to do is to say, "I don't know. Emily just taught me this dance and tell me to do it." I think we need to hold more on our plate in terms of understanding dance, because we're not just dancer. I see all of them as artists. And I tell them they are ambassador to tell people how, if you're coming from a contemporary background, then tell people the differences then that you find. What do you like about it? What don't you like about it? It's okay. And also to make sure that you study. And I often tell my dancers about each dance I'm teaching. So every time we start off with a dance, I will give them a lot of different historic background about the culture. So for example, if it's Mongolian dance, I'll tell them where it's located and what do the Mongolian people do and how come they always walk like this. It's because they're wearing boots, they're in the prairies a lot, and they're known for horseback riding. So I would tell them a lot of things so that they know, they can imagine, like if I am in the prairies and I don't have a vehicle, all I have is a horse, then that's why I have to wear boots all the time, and that's why my movement look really heavy, and they appreciate that. And so those are some of the communication I have with them. We want to make sure that all our dancers come out with a deep understanding of, or at least hoping that they will appreciate what what the little pair is giving them, and also take it on to their own journey when they're learning other people's like culture and really absorbing it. So it is more than we're more than just a dancer. They're more than just a dancer. They're really ambassador in their own kind of artistry. And I want them to travel and carry on this legacy. There's this ethnic group in China called the Wa dance, and they are in the mountains somewhere, really remote to anybody, basically, except for themselves. So I often say, we need to make sure that, we do respect the culture by, talking to the villagers there, and also to gain more insights, because otherwise it is just an imitation of dance. Dance is just like a form where we imitate. But why do folk dance, like the people there, do it so often? Every time there's a celebration, they will come together in a village and they hold hands and dance. It's because it is part of the community. It is part of what they do, and it has everything to do with the custom, the weather, the geographic location. It's everything. So it's very important that we study it, and hopefully, in the long run, they will also teach it to other people.
Little Pear Garden Dance Company recently premiered a work in progress entitled Nine-Tailed Fox. Now, an excerpt of this story, Emily, will also be presented at the Asian Heritage Month Concert 2024, Stories of Triumph, Tragedy, and Compassion, which is all going to be presented by the Canadian Foundation for Asian Culture. And that's going to be coming up today, in fact. Share with us, please, about the historical context of Nine-Tailed Fox.
Certainly, Nicole. So Nine-Tailed Fox has to do another legendary story, and it has to do with also demon one more time. All these ancient story has a lot of demon story-like. The ending is, funny enough, different depending on where you are. In Japan, the ending is going to be different than in Korea, but all of the Asian country really know about the Nine-Tailed Fox, and they have their own kind of ending to the story. Now, being here in Canada, once again, we have this time been lucky enough to invited Diana Chow, who is also a local Canadian female writer, to write about the Nine-Tailed Fox in her own way. So she wrote three stories, and Alice, a renowned, very famous composer, composed these music based on her story, in which then I choreographed the movement vocabulary onto Diana's storytelling. The storytelling is going to be quite different. It's basically through her own journey of imagination. And each of the story ends differently, and it does, you know, it reveals a lot of various emotion with it too. So, for example, the first story has to do with a scholar entering a haunted house where there's tons of demons, fox demons, nine-tailed fox. And in the end, the two fox, the female and the male Nine-Tailed Fox, found out there's a scholar in the house, and they transformed the haunted house into a glamorous ballroom just to get the scholar drunk, because they saw their transformation from fox to human, so they want the scholar to forget it altogether. And so that's what they did. They got him really drunk in the end. He woke up, it's like, oh, is this a dream? But wait a minute, why is there a flower that was given to me by the female fox? And I have it on my hand. Now, is this real or not? You know, so these stories really capture the emotion of these artists, the dancers I'm working with. And and I would love to have you come and witness the storytelling along with Vanya, who is the opera singer.
I would absolutely love to. Thank you for that invite. And we also want to encourage our audience to learn more about the event and also shares about Asian Heritage Month. Please visit www.vmacch.ca. Now, that is the Canadian Foundation for Asian Culture.
That's right. And you will also witness Korean dance, and as well as lots of music. I think Indian dance, Indian music, with someone playing the tabla as well. So it is a true celebration of various different culture in Asia.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, Emily, as we begin to work towards the close of our interview, I want to say just how much of an honor and a pleasure it's been speaking with you. But before we close, I want to come back to something that William Lau had shared with you. Tai Song Sik Fang.
Very good. Very, very good. Tai Song Sik Fang, yes.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to come back to that because I would love to know those words, what they mean for you, Emily, as you continue to drive the company forward.
So Tai Song Sik Fan, this saying is quite funny, like, because it basically means like, don't overspend, spend whatever you have means, which in the arts is relatively more realistic mindset than the dreamy mindset where, oh, I want to have a big stage, I want 50 dancers. So there's always all these wants for artists in terms of how they want to put up a show, and always, you know, you can go as glamorous as possible, but in reality, we always have to see, okay, well, how much can we spend for things? And so so this is why we often, William taught me this, and I was teaching everyone that too around me. So, 台上吃饭, yes.
Wonderful. Well, Emily, I want to say again how much of a joy it has been to sit down to share with you. Thank you for being such a fabulous flow of light.
Thank you.
On our show today.
Thank you so much, Nicole. And thank you for interviewing me. I really appreciate all your questions. They were so genuinely good. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Such a pleasure, Emily. I look forward to seeing you again very, very soon.
Likewise.
Today, you've been listening to the sounds of Cannonball Adderley with Autumn Leaves and John Coltrane with Blue Train. Welcome back to Turnout Radio on CIUT 89.5 FM. Well, we've come to the close of our broadcast. I want to thank Emily Chung for joining me on the show. So grateful for her insightful shares on the program. To learn more about the Little Pear Garden Dance Company, we invite you to visit littlepeargarden.com. And if you missed the top of the interview, we've got you covered, friends. Visit turnoutradio.com and ciut.fm, where the full episode will soon be streaming. Technical production of today's show was facilitated by Brittany Bob. Join us again next week for more of Turnout Radio. I'm Nicole Inica Hamilton. I hope your week finds you turning out to dance.